This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm going to be with you till 2 p.m. with two very interesting interviews. We're going to start out with the classical music critic for the New Yorker magazine, Alex Ross, who a year ago published a massive book, The Rest Is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. It's, with all the notes and everything, almost 700 pages. Fascinating book, which went on to win a number of prizes. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award. And it was New York Times, one of their 10 best books of the year. It's just come out in paperback, and Alex Ross is going to be in San Francisco this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. He's going to be in conversation with the San Francisco Chronicle music critic Joshua Kossman at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco. I don't have more information about that. You'll have to get it on your own. But we might get a bit of a preview of that in the conversation this afternoon. I'm not a music critic. I'm nowhere near as knowledgeable as either of those two people. But I was fascinated by the contents of the book, and I'm very glad to be talking with Alex Ross right now. Welcome to Booktown, Alex.
Thanks, Eric. Good to talk to you.
As I said, this is a massive undertaking. I think you spent 10 years working on it?
Just about, if you include the research and the sort of preliminary procrastination.
Right.
About 5 or 6 years of writing, although I was also producing for The New Yorker during the same period, so I went back and forth. But yeah, it was a long haul.
But I think quite worth it. I will say that as a person who's very interested in classical music, I knew about probably two-thirds of the material that's in here, but I was nonetheless fascinated by the way you put it together, the juxtapositions, and even more by the material that was completely new to me. Somebody like Olivier Messiaen is someone I'm just getting to know, and I'm eager to get to know more about him after reading what you had to say. You start out with the 20th century at a time when what we think of as classical music was sort of at its peak of prestige, when Richard Strauss's Salome was being performed in Graz in Austria. Everybody who was everybody politically, musically, and so on went there and talked about it for months. At the end of the century, it was no classical performance would ever have attracted that sort of attention. What happened in those 100 years?
Well, it's actually kind of a complex question. What happened to classical music, and you know, did it decline or did it simply evolve? I mean, on one level, yes, composers today don't have anything like the reputations that Richard Strauss and Gustav Mahler and the young Igor Stravinsky and the other leading composers of the first couple decades of the century had. Then, in terms of media exposure, I mean, when Strauss first came to this country in 1904, there were huge articles about him in the newspapers. When he went to Washington, he was invited onto the floor of the Senate and was received by Roosevelt at the White House. I mean, can you imagine a composer being given that kind of treatment today? Puccini, when he first came to America, there was a little item that ran in the New York Times saying, Puccini's ship is stuck in fog and it's going to be delayed. You know, people were so anxious to read about his progress. So obviously we don't see those kinds of stories today. And yet, you know, on the other hand, I think collectively there are many more people listening to classical music around the world right now than there were in 1900, 1910. I mean, if you look at the audiences for classical music in China, in, South America, all around the world, and even here, there are more orchestras, many more orchestras and opera houses. So actually, when you add up the sheer numbers of people, it's bigger. But it doesn't feel bigger. So there's been a kind of a cultural decline, a loss of eminence at that level, and I think that's a big part of the story of this book. You know, why that happened, what kinds of social and cultural pressures came to bear, and the story really is that, you know, composers had to deal with a much more diverse culture in the 20th century. Popular music, all the different varieties of popular music were competing for people's attention and grabbing the better part of it. And, the changes in technology and in society, in how concerts would be paid for and how the audience would receive them. So massive changes. But I think it's kind of an interesting story of survival in the end, through some very terrifying episodes in the middle of the century as composers fell into the grip of totalitarian dictators, or even in this country, Aaron Copland being called before Senator McCarthy's committee in the 1950s, being buffeted from all sides, but surviving. And a composer like John Adams in the Bay Area today does have a very significant position, even if, you know, the even if his travels aren't reported on a daily basis in the paper.
But then many, many pieces of music or forms of music, types of tonality, types of harmony, types of rhythm that were considered scandalous 50 years ago or even 15 years ago, you now hear them in movies, you hear them in pop music, you hear them almost everywhere. And people are sort of expected, if there's a classical motif in an automobile ad on TV, people are sort of expected to know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how the radical loses its scary edge and becomes mainstream. It was actually happening long ago. I mean, if you just look at the fact that Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which caused such a riot at its premiere in 1913, you know, by 1940, Disney was using it in Fantasia. So there was already a mainstreaming effect that happened there. You know, composers of Hollywood scores, particularly thrillers, horror movies, sci-fi movies, you know, were mining the 20th century avant-garde for ideas. There was quite a bit of resistance from the audience early on. Frankly, there still is. Some of these composers cause unease when they appear in concert halls, but we've come a long way toward, I think, treating composers the same way we do painters, modernist painters, modernist writers, which is with a certain respect. Even if we don't immediately understand what we're trying to get at, we acknowledge that Picasso is a great painter, Rothko is a great painter, you know, Joyce, a great writer, and it's sort of our responsibility sometimes, if we're willing, to try to come to terms with this work. And composers deserve the same respect, and they were so long dismissed as sort of, you know, perpetrating noise and chaos. And at the beginning of the 21st century, I think we may be coming around to a deeper appreciation of what they were doing.
But of course, the politics of music plays a big part in the book. Part of it is how particular composers had to deal with the politics of their countries. You mentioned Copland, but also Shostakovich and Prokofiev in the Soviet Union, just about everybody under fascism and Nazism. But then there was also the politics among musicians, who they would promote, who they would even acknowledge, and who they would try to dismiss or disparage or even undermine if possible. It seems like a lot of the 20th century was, I get the impression that the musicians, composers, whether they wanted to be or not, were much more politically involved than any previous time in both senses, both big politics and internal politics.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an intensification that happened. I mean, a lot of the book is about those two kinds of politics. the politics in the big sense, how a composer like Shostakovich coped with Stalin and his regime, how Richard Strauss kind of maneuvered his way uneasily through Hitler's Germany and then managed to emerge at the other end, not with his reputation intact, but still writing a wonderful music and then simply having survived that circumstance. So there's that kind of politics. And then, yeah, the internal stuff, the infighting, the constant sort of polemics back and forth, the really sometimes quite brutal rhetorical attacks that avant-garde composers would launch at conservatives and conservatives would launch back in return. And I think that came about. I mean, I have some fun describing all this and looking back on it, some of it seems quite ridiculous and over the top. But, there was a serious question emerging here that people were confronting sometimes in this very strong language, which is, well, where are we going to go now? As the 20th century begins to unfold, there had been this long heyday of romanticism and this language that was basically rooted in Central Europe, especially the German-speaking countries. And, of course, there was Italian opera as well, but, that Wagner-Brahms language had been so central for a while. And then I think, especially after the First World War, it just seemed like we've got to go in some different direction. That old civilization felt so damaged. So just this wild experimentation. Can we use jazz? Can we use blues? Can we imitate the sound of machines? Can we go back before the Romantic era to the Baroque, to the Renaissance? Can we invent this tremendously complex new language of 12-tone writing and sort of ordering notes in mathematical rows and on and on? So, obviously there was some, contention as people jockey for a position, but it's also quite exciting. I mean, this sense of wild experiment and sort of trying every possibility, and actually that has really gone on to this day, and all of those directions that sort of multiplied, especially in the 1920s, they're all still very alive and well right now among, even among the youngest composers.
This brings up the whole question of music festivals, which played a huge part in the 20th century. They hardly existed before Wagner, and yet in the 20th century they were places where new music would be put out or where battles, polemics would be fought.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how they developed? You never give a succinct description. You mention them here and there throughout the book. I wonder, is there a succinct description you can give?
Yeah, I mean, well, there is a sort of whole history to it. I think, again, the 20s are the time when this really got going, although even in the first decade of the 20th century, sort of festival culture got underway. But in the 20s, you had the International Society for Contemporary Music. You had the festival at Donaueschingen in Germany. And there came to be these gathering places where composers would congregate and offer up their latest works in an atmosphere where there was definitely more freedom to experiment and sort of wilder ideas could be tried out without this worry that the conventional classical audience would pass judgment and sort of walk out in a huff. So some quite wild and crazy things went on at those festivals in the 20s, including actually the first draft, the initial group of songs that became Weill and Brecht's great Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, that was first heard at one of the festivals. So this really intensified after the Second World War. Suddenly, I think every major European country had a bunch of these summer festivals or sort of any time of year. One of the most interesting cases happened in the city of Darmstadt in Germany. This wasn't a festival as such. It was a summer new music institute that started up in 1946. And interestingly enough, it was supported in part by the U.S. Army, the kind of cultural reorientation, psychological warfare department of the U.S. Army was looking for opportunities to encourage sort of new modes of thinking in German culture that would represent a break from Nazism, from Nazi culture, and this very cosmopolitan, sophisticated, avant-garde new music series was one of the things that they encouraged. So the U.S. Army was giving money to a little extent to these 12-tone composers, and then the various waves of avant-gardism which followed from there. And by the 1950s and 1960s, Darmstadt was the place where you went as a young composer to prove yourself and sort of throw out your wild new idea.
One of your chapters, which is largely about Arnold Schoenberg, is entitled Dr. Faust. It refers, of course, to Thomas Mann's novel, Dr. Faustus, whose main character, Adrian Lebkuhn, is somewhat based on Schoenberg, or at least on his theories. You only have one chapter on that character, that book, but it keeps popping up all through the book, that various composers say how much they were influenced by reading that, and the whole idea that to be a 20th century composer, you sort of had to renounce the public and sell your soul to the devil for some arcane knowledge.
Right. Well, that's, of course, a rather provocative metaphor. But I think, well, that book had such an effect on me. I first read it when I was 18 or so, and I was just completely gripped by it. I had tried to be a composer growing up, and I was sort of giving up the dream of composing because I just had no talent for it at that time. But I was so mesmerized by this fictional portrait of a composer, which seemed so true to life. And as I later discovered, it was because Mann knew Schoenberg, had known many composers, and did very assiduous research in building up the musical component of that novel. And you know, on the one hand, it is a very dark, frightening portrait of artistic madness, and it's also, I think, all a very complex metaphor for the artist's involvement in Nazism, which Mann was observing from afar in Los Angeles. But there's also something thrilling about the extremities to which this man goes, Adrian Lebkuhn, the composer, and I think a lot of composers of the post-war era identified with that sort of mad search for the new, and yet the kind of a fleeing from the public sphere into private experiment, which is actually only one component of the 20th century story. But I refer to the book many times in my own book. I sometimes thought of it as a denovelization of Dr. Faustus, that makes any sense. But I sort of think of it as a Faustian tale with a happy ending, because the composers don't lose their minds. They do survive. The tradition continues. They don't go under. In a way, music survives Nazism and Stalinism and continues to evolve and adapt to contemporary culture. So in the end, this is not a Faustian story in that sense. It's kind of a overcoming of that Faustian problem.
I also noticed reading through the book, I was getting this feeling, and then on page 511 you came out and said it explicitly, that the 20th century has had much more overtly religious music, or I would say more creative religious music. There's always been masses and chorales written, but this is a period when religious music moved into the concert hall, and where it seemed to be taken much more seriously by so many composers, not just as something they had to do as a job, but something they were really wrestling with.
Yeah, I'm very glad you picked up on that, actually, because that was an important recurring theme of the book for me. I'm not a doctrinaire religious person, but I do respond very powerfully to religious music of all periods, and I think in particular the religious music of the 20th century represents a very powerful revival of religious tradition. I mean, actually, if you look at the 19th century, there's not a lot of really explicitly religious music, and works such as Beethoven's Missa Solemnis and the Berlioz and Verdi Requiems, you feel as though these are works where you know, it's sort of, you know, hard to locate them within the conventional religious tradition. They sort of stand somewhat outside of it. Whereas in the 20th century, I mean, you have a composer like Messiaen, Olivier Messiaen, the great French master, who was profoundly religious, sort of a Catholic of a very traditional type, but his music is by no means dogmatic or conventional, and he offers up these wildly colorful, overwhelmingly diverse musical images to express his spiritual feeling in a way that I think listeners of all different backgrounds can respond to. There's something almost pantheistic about his music at times, and also intensely sensual, this great riot of color and feeling. And so, you know, that is such a great addition to the religious repertory, as well as, you know, Stravinsky's magnificent religious works, the Symphony of Psalms, above all, I think. Frank Martin and Arvo Pärt in our own age, even Karlheinz Stockhausen, that wild man of the German avant-garde, was a practicing Catholic, at least for the first part of his life, and there's a religious undertow to some of his most far-out pieces of the 1950s, especially Benjamin Britten, too, I should mention, the War Requiem. You know, so this is a thread that goes through the book. I don't write an entire chapter on this topic, but it was a very important part of the story for me.
I've been listening to Messiaen's Turangalila symphony. I think just happened to hear it four times in the last month. Mm-hmm. The first time I was just put it on while I was doing other things, and it didn't make much impression on me. The second time was just before I started reading your book, and I was very impressed. Third time I went back and thought, what a lot of bombast. And then the fourth time, about 3 days ago, it was really beginning to sink into me. Uh-huh. I think that may be the sort of kind of music that you can't assimilate in one time, unless you're a better listener than I am.
Yeah, no, actually, I've had the same experience with that piece, I think, early on. I mean, there were parts of it that I loved, and then other parts of it that sort of gave me an ice cream headache or something. It's actually the last couple times that I've heard it live, I really felt like I've started to come to terms with it. And, yeah, you need to live with some of this music. I think just as, you know, certain paintings, the first time you walk by them, they may make no sense, and only maybe 5 years later you come back to the same museum and suddenly the painting begins to speak to you. I think we need to give music that second, third, and fourth chance as well. And you know, I think unfortunately for a lot of people, they, you know, they have one bad experience with a modern work and they kind of write off the whole thing. And so I really encourage people to go back and listen again. And I have a feature on a website, therestisnoise.com. I have an audio guide with pages for each chapter of the book, and you can go and sort of dip your toe in and get a sense of what these pieces sound like if you're reading the book, and then hopefully go on from there to get some recordings, or even better, to go see a live performance.
And I should mention that the website also has a glossary of terms that's quite comprehensive, and some video and some little and still photographs and little snippets, like your comparison of Queen's We Will Rock You with Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man.
Yeah, that's up on the front of the blog right now. It's something I came across, which amused me. But yeah, I think, you know, it is a great facility to have the internet to be able to provide examples of this kind to go along with a book. And I've spent a lot of time just over this past summer adding new material, so I hope it will be a useful resource for people.
And if anybody needs to know more about that, this program also is archived, and there's a link to therestismusic.com on
The Rest Is Noise.
The Rest Is Noise, I'm sorry. Sorry, that was one final question. You give a very broad sweep covering so many of the major movements, but you do leave out many traditionalists, people like Vaughan Williams or Rachmaninoff or Puccini. You barely mention at all.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a particular reason because you thought that they maybe represented the end of traditions rather than ongoing ones?
No, not at all. I mean, it was a very painful process cutting this book down from the initial first draft, which was, believe it or not, twice as long as the final version. And I had to make many painful decisions. I love Vaughan Williams' symphonies, actually, and I wrote a whole little mini essay about his sixth symphony, which is such a masterpiece, which I then cut out, not because I don't think it's a great work, but because thinking of the first-time reader who doesn't know many of these names, I didn't want to overwhelm him or her with too much material, so I had to really be very selective. And there were certain composers who, for whatever reason, just seemed to work better than others at advancing the main narratives along, the sort of main themes I had going, and it was ultimately not a question of quality as such, but which figures would really serve to advance the story. And so the people that I really focus on here are not the be-all, end-all, and I really hope that people will, if they're discovering this music for the first time, will go on to explore all the others whom I only touch on or don't mention at all.
And you also, in some cases, give a huge amount of emphasis to one particular work. In some cases, like Salome, that makes sense because that's at the beginning. But with Britten, the analysis of Peter Grimes must be well over 10 pages.
Yeah, again, I sort of use this as a... it's sort of an emblematic work. I thought instead of constantly just having one paragraph here about one piece and a couple paragraphs there, I really wanted to zero in on something and describe it in much greater detail. And Grimes was the piece in the latter half of the book that I really chose to devote that kind of length to. But again, it was just something that felt right for me. It felt good to sort of stop that forward-rushing chronological narrative in its tracks for a little while and focus on this one piece. But it could have been any number of other pieces, and that was just one that I feel very close to. I think it's such an amazing piece and one that you can, go from there on to so many other things.
This is Book Down on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Alex Ross, who's the classical music critic for The New Yorker. And his book, which I couldn't recommend more highly, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century, has just come out in paperback. And he will be in San Francisco this coming Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center, talking with Joshua Kosman, who's the music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much for coming on, and I will continue to spread the word about your book.
Oh, thank you so much, Erica. It's great to talk to you.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk with David Peaty, who's the publisher of Whereabouts Books from Berkeley. And it's it does have other books as well, but the main emphasis of the company is the series called A Traveler's Literary Companion. As traveling gets more and more sophisticated and widespread, I think you could say, more and more people are moving around the world, people don't just want their old Baedekers or Frommers or Fieldings. The travel guides get much more detailed. There's been a bunch of literary ones. I know there's A Traveler's History of Any Country You Want to Go to. This series has some. There's also a series called Traveler's Tales, which is mostly collections of articles by people who've been to particular countries. So you'd get a traveler's tales of Scotland, possibly, or you'd get a traveler's history of Chile or something like that. The traveler's literary companions are different in that they have stories by native writers about different parts of the country. I have three of them on hand. There's well over a dozen now. The three I have are China, Japan, and France. And I'll be talking with David Peaty about those, but also about the entire scope of the series and what they've done, what they're planning to do. So welcome to Booktown, David Peaty.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Eric. I really appreciate it.
How did you get this idea?
Well, we started We're About to Press, my partner Ellen Tal and I, back in the early 1990s, and she was actually planning a trip to visit her brother in Costa Rica at the time, and she was trying to put together a reading list and was really having a rather difficult time. And she and I had been talking about basically trying to come up with a publishing program of some kind, and realized, well, this was something that was really lacking, basically something small that you could carry with you, travel, and that had a nice little introduction to writers of a place. And so the very first book that we did was a Costa Rica book. We hired someone who is sort of a specialist in the field of Costa Rican literature. There wasn't very much out there. We knew that if we did come out with a book, that there really wouldn't be that much competition. And so that was the very first one that we did. We had no idea, really, that it was going to be a series. But the success of it has now sold over 35,000 copies, made us realize that this was something we really wanted to pursue.
And by now you have not only countries but also cities.
Right, and that's a little bit more difficult for the editors we hire putting them together, because the stories that we ask them to select for the books have to have sort of a sense of place. I mean, obviously all short stories or literature doesn't necessarily have that. Sometimes it can just be sort of very cerebral and in someone's mind. But we really wanted to select stories that where someone, as they're traveling through the country, can really recognize the area that they're traveling through while they're reading these stories, so that both improves the experience of the other. The traveling improves the experience of reading, and the reading improves the experience of the traveling.
How did you pick the editors?
That's always an interesting question. It's an interesting mix of people. Often they are scholars who are sort of the leading specialists in the field from various universities within the U.S. Or they can just be someone. The editor of the Cuba book, for instance, Annie Bardak, is sort of a journalist first and foremost, but she has a real passion and love for Cuban literature. So she was a really wonderful choice for that. So not all scholars would be perfect, I think, for this kind of thing, because, you know, these books are not scholarly in any way. They're really meant to be accessible and a wonderful sort of general introduction to a country's literature. And some scholars really get that. And, in fact, you know, the editor of the China book, I think, has put together some amazing tomes, real large anthologies of contemporary Chinese literature. But he really jumped at the opportunity to come out with this much smaller collection of contemporary Chinese stories that was really going to introduce his, you know, what he's been spending his scholarly life doing to a much broader audience. And I think he really enjoyed that, even though it's outside of sort of the main field of what he's doing as a scholar.
In the three volumes that I've been looking through, France, Japan, and China, I notice a pattern which may not persist in the other books, I don't know, but there seem to be about three, possibly four, writers with strong international reputations, and mostly from 40 or 50 years ago, and then a good number of lesser-known people who are quite often more contemporary, like in the Chinese one I've got in front, the pretty much the first three authors are the best known, Lucian, Mao Dun, and Zhang Ailin, also known as Eileen Chang. And in the France, it has Colette and Marcel Aimé. But then more recent people like Jean-Marie Gustave Leclaisiel, who just won the Nobel Prize. But a lot of the contemporary French writers I've never heard of.
Right, and probably you've never heard of Leclaisiel until he won the Nobel Prize.
I already had this book.
Oh, that's true.
But I didn't know much more than that.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a pattern, but I would say most of the books certainly include some of the big name writers, only because that's sort of one of the things that we ask the editors who are putting these together is obviously, you know, we want the reader to be able to pick up one of these books and recognize at least some of the names in there and say, oh, you know, a Colette piece, I love Colette. But you'll notice that there are some big names missing as well. There's no Camus in there. And very often the big name writers just haven't written something that fits within the scope of what we're looking for here. So, for instance, we're looking for something, you know, that's reasonably short and will fit within the parameters of such a small book, something with a sense of place. And very often that doesn't happen. For instance, the book that we did on Prague, there's no Milan Kundera in there, and I think that might be a surprise to some people, but he really didn't write anything that was very Prague-centered. And so very often people will pick these up and think that there's some, you know, glaring omissions or something, but I think the pieces are generally very thoughtfully put together and have a whole bunch of criteria that we've asked the editors to consider when they put them together. So in addition to the big names, there are obviously lesser-known writers that the editors really are excited about introducing to the general public, but we do ask that they also include some of the bigger names just to draw people in.
Now, you could have included Camus in Amsterdam because The Fall takes place in an Amsterdam bar.
Right.
But as I remember, it could have been a bar any place in the world.
Right. And one of the things is that we are trying to get people who are of that place. This is not, you know, Western travel writing. For instance, you mentioned Traveler's Tales, and they put together some wonderful books, but we're really trying to do something distinctly different, which is really provide stories through the eyes of these writers that are of the place. Now, there are some interesting sort of exceptions to that. So, for instance, we put out a Prague book, and we're putting out a Vienna book, and Kafka is in both of those, and he's, you know, the Vietnam book, for instance, has, because of the nature of what happened to the writing community, the contemporary writing community, because of the war and whatnot, there are some expats who are writing for the Vietnam book, although in general we're not doing that. We're really trying to get people who are of that place.
I've noticed a big, well, of course, the countries are so different in size that your sense of regionality varies very much from a place like China or Australia to countries as small as Costa Rica or Ireland or Israel. Nonetheless, I was fascinated that in the French volume, fully a third of the stories take place in Paris and its suburbs. And in the China book, only one takes place in Beijing.
Right, and I think that there are a couple of reasons for that, but each of these books really belies the approach of each of the editors who are putting it together. First of all, on one level, the audacity of trying to put together a 250-page book, a collection of short stories from China is, you know, amazing. I mean, it's ridiculous to really try to undertake on some level because there's obviously so many places that weren't represented. So, you know, the editor for the China book was really put to the test to try to really present stories from a real broad area. And yet, at the same time, you know, with the Costa Rica book, that's small, or the Prague book, or the city-focused one, Prague, Amsterdam, Vienna, you know, they're obviously, they have the challenge of trying to make sure that the city's geography is represented in a way that challenge is a very different one. But they're all challenges nonetheless.
Now, whenever I've mentioned something about one of these books, you seem to know instantly what I'm talking about. Not all publishers know everything they publish that well. You're very hands-on, I take it.
Well, it's a very small list, so I And I'm pretty much the sole employee. I have some wonderful freelancers who work with me, but Whereabouts Press at this point is pretty much the sole employee is me. So I have to on some level. But the great thing is each one of these books is such a learning experience for me. I mean, every time we do, you know, my knowledge of Chinese literature was really negligible before I started this process. And not that I'm that knowledgeable now, but each one of these books is just such a pleasure to work on, because they're being introduced to this whole new area of literature and translation is just really wonderful.
You mentioned that the first one, the Costa Rican one, did much better than you expected. How's the series as a whole doing?
You know, the series as a whole really, it's kind of all over the place, and in ways that as a publisher, I would like to say I could have predicted, but I really didn't. The success of the Costa Rica one still has me a little bit surprised. Costa Rica is a very popular travel destination, but I don't usually think of it as a cultural travel destination the way, you know, France is or Italy. I think of it as lots of ecotourism there. But I think there are a couple things. One, there are the book was recognized early on as being something that would really add to a travel experience. So a number of travel companies added them to their list. But I think also there's just very little competition out there. There aren't, even though there aren't that many other collections of Costa Rican writers, there really are some amazing Costa Rican writers out there. And so the mere fact that it's out there, it's gained a lot of attention that way. I remember when we first proposed this to publish this to our distributor, the reaction I sort of got was, why Costa Rica? That's, you know, no great writers come out of Costa Rica. And of course, that's not true. But, you know, compared to Argentina or some other Latin American place where, you know, there are these big names that, you know, we in America recognize now. I think once the book was published and people realized what great writing there was, it really caught on. There are a couple of disappointments. I think Amsterdam is one. It's a wonderful book, but it came out right after 9/11, and I think it really just never picked up after that. You know, book sales in general plummeted. Anything travel-related plummeted. And we've sort of been, ever since then, trying to do what we can to improve those sales through special sales to groups going to Amsterdam. But that's been a hard one.
In general, do you pick the countries you're going to deal with according to how many people might be going there, or according to the quality of the literature available, or is it a combination of the two, or do you just throw a dart at the dartboard?
Well, the first thing I would say is I think any destination has literature that's worth publishing a book on. I've always been surprised at how much I've enjoyed every different location and how much there is to offer. And the difficulty for every editor is putting this together as to what not to include, because there's usually so much. So, in terms of picking destinations, you know, I'd like to say as a publisher, I've really been very thoughtful about this, and that we're very methodical in our business plan. But very often, it'll be because I become captivated by a place, and I talk with someone who I think would be a wonderful editor, and that's often the reason why. We're one of the books that's in the works right now. In fact, the next book to go off to press is one on South Africa, and you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do that one is we simply haven't done one on the African continent yet. We're also considering a Morocco volume, and I'd love to do that. So a lot of it is just really my own interest. But when we started doing the series, what we really wanted to do was pick places like Costa Rica that were a little bit off the beaten path of what sort of mainstay American travel. That's changed mainly because I think as a business plan, it was important for us to come out with books that we knew were going to be successful. France, obviously, Italy, those have done very well for us because there are so many Americans who travel there. But along with those, it's really been important for us to do the more off-the-beaten-path kinds of places like Vietnam.
You've done Mexico. Have you considered Canada?
We have considered Canada, and in fact, we probably will do one. My guess is that we'll break it up into two volumes. One is sort of maybe British Columbia area, another one in the Quebec, Montreal area. And it really makes sense, I think, especially now with travel on the decline, going off to Europe where the dollar is doing so poorly, and now where, you know, the economy is tanking everywhere, then trying to pick places that are a little bit closer. So we've done Mexico. We'd like to do Canada. We're even considering maybe we try doing something comparable like this within the United States, each state having something to offer that's unique on its own. We haven't made the decision to do that, but that's definitely something that we're considering.
That was going to be my next question. If you did do the U.S., you might break it up by states or by regions?
Yeah. You know, it's really a question of what makes the most sense in terms of the literature, that's how specifically identifiable it is to a region versus to a state, but also just in terms of, you know, how narrowly do we want to limit the market, depending on how much tourism that place has or how many people within that state who are interested are in reading their own state's literature. So that's something I haven't researched very much, but I'm looking into it.
In terms of marketing, you mentioned trying to do tie-ins with travel organizations. Has that been successful, or do you still sell most of your books through bookstores or online? Or
Most of our books are sold through bookstores. We have a couple of online distributors who do very well for us. I wish we had a better success in connecting with both things like study abroad programs and also alumni travel, cultural travel, those kinds of things. We've been successful here and there. When we've made those connections, I think they've done quite well, not only for us, but for the organizing group. But that's something that we definitely need to improve on.
How you said that you started this because of the Costa Rican idea, because your co-founder came up with that idea. What had you been doing before publishing, and now that you're in it, are you stuck?
I'm fortunately, I think I am stuck in it. I love publishing, and I really enjoy it. Before that point, I had been working for 10 Speed Press here in Berkeley. My partner, Alan Tal, had been working for North Point Press, which is a wonderful literary press that was going under at the time that she and I started talking about maybe starting a publishing program on our own. North Point Press had a wonderful literature and translation series. It's not a series, but they did a lot of wonderful literature and translation. And it was during that time that she worked at North Point that I started reading more and more literature and translation than I had even been before. And I think when we were talking about what we wanted to do as publishers, we realized this was a not only a love of ours and something that we really wanted to see if we could make into a legitimate publishing program, something that was financially feasible. But we really loved experiencing these different types of literature that come through translation. And the thing that I find that's really compelling about each of these books is, as you're reading these stories, what you can find in common in terms of humanity that binds us all, but yet at the same time, what it is that's so different. And that's that dichotomy is really what makes the series really interesting to me. And because we had this love of literature and translation, we knew once we came up with this idea that this is something that we really wanted to pursue, because not only did we love it, we really felt that it was important to do, and we thought we could do it in a financially viable way, and we did.
So you're going to stick with this series or this approach? You're not going to move into other directions?
Well, for now, I'm going to stick with it, partly because I really want the series to gain enough of a mass in terms of the number of volumes out there that people will say, oh, I'm thinking of going to South Africa. I wonder if Whereabouts has done a book on this. On South Africa, as opposed to stumbling across one of our titles and not even realizing that it's part of a series. So I'm really hoping that that will happen. We, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, we have done some books outside of the series. We did a two-volume set, one on gay travels and lesbian travels, really wonderful collections. And then we also did a collection of short stories about pilgrimages, another book that I'm really proud that we've done. And I hope that we can expand outside of the series, just because I'd love to do more if we can. But for now, I'm focusing on the series really just so that the series, each volume of the series, can kind of benefit from the whole growth of the series.
You mentioned Ten Speed and North Point, which are, well, it's too, North Point is not around anymore, unfortunately, because they may have been a little too ambitious in what, they may have been too high class. But I get the impression in general that more and more of the creative energy in American publishing is coming from the West Coast, as East Coast companies are getting more and more conglomerized.
Yeah, well, I've always said that one of the advantages to a small company like Whereabouts is that it has the ability to maneuver a little bit more quickly and responsibly. I mean, for instance, you're saying that I know so much about the books that I publish. I really don't know any more than I think anybody who would be publishing this number of books could. If I were in a larger publishing company and we published, you know, the number of volumes that I do have in the series as a whole every season, I would have a tough time sort of staying on top of it. But I think one of the things that the smaller West Coast publishers can do is, one, you know, they find a niche and really thoroughly explore that niche and really figure out what's the best we can do in that niche. But also, they just can maneuver a little bit more quickly. They don't have this massive bulk that they have to shift around. That said, of course, there are, you know, lots of problems for any small publisher trying to make inroads in a publishing market where there's already way too many books published as it is. So it's there are the pluses and minuses, of course.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with David Peaty, who's the publisher, and he says sole employee of Whereabouts Books in Berkeley. They publish the Traveler's Literary Companions. And I've been very pleased to be talking with you for the last half hour, and now I've got to get out of here.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, thanks. One quick upcoming event that's happening before I make way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party. The North Columbia Poetry Series presents readings and improvisations and poetic relays featuring Dale Pendle and his wife Laura Pendle, Friday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the North Columbia Cultural Center on the San Juan Ridge. If you want more information, call 292-3892. And this has been Booktown on KVMR-FM, Nevada City. Now stay tuned for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party.